Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
But they made too much money, Chevron, too much money, ExxonMobil, too much money. When you look at one company where they made 12 times what they made the year before, they're going to give some of that back to the public, and they better cut the retail price, the consumer price. Too much money. You surprised I'm saying it? I'll say it loud and clear. I'm not happy about it. Go ahead.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red Podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko in Niles, Ohio.
And then we're also joined today, once again, by
Clayton Lust, here in Houston, Texas.
Yeah, Clayton is our friend and a regular guest. He's a historian, activist, teacher, conqueror, and warper of minds. And just to remind folks that this podcast is made by the generosity of you, our audience. So I want to encourage people to go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast.
Before Scott came on, you saw our favorite crazy uncle talking about the fact that oil companies are making way too much money. Their prices are too high. Their profits have soared way more than they should have, that they should give some of those profits back and that they should make cuts in their retail prices. Now, I don't know about you, but what does that sound like to you? Is that American? Is that capitalism? I don't think so. So that's what we're going to talk about today. In the past, couple months or so, a specter has been haunting America, the specter of communism, right? We've had, for the first time in a while, actually, a big national political hysteria about the left. Trump has played with this before, radical left Marxists, but it was always directed at people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, so it could be fairly easily laughed off, right? But with the emergence, especially in the last spate of elections, of the Democratic Socialists of America, who've been very successful. They've won seats in New York, Minnesota, Colorado, I believe. There are primaries going on today in Michigan where a couple DSA congressional candidates have a good chance of winning. The Senate candidate there, who's not part of DSA but has a lot of the same issues as DSA, Abdul El-Sayed, is favored to win. And this is putting the political class into a big panic, not just the Republicans who are using this. If you look at social media, every third post is some Republican congressman with a sickle and hammer and this foreboding image of a jail cell in Korea or wherever, I don't know. And then obviously the Democrats are in total meltdown mode. All the old timers, the geriatric old affluent men like Carville and the talking heads and Schumer are concerned that these radicals are going to ruin it for their brilliant centrist candidates. And those centrists have really done well in the last several years, haven't they? Remember that President Dukakis's administration, fantastic. President Gore's years, unbelievable. President Kerry's years, unprecedented prosperity. President Clinton, President Harris, just brilliant, right? They're frightened by it as well. So what we want to do today is talk about these attacks on DSA and other groups, accusing them of being socialist or even communist. They're obviously insane, as people listening to this now pretty much know. So let's talk about what socialism means, and especially within the American context. I want to very briefly just give a little riff on socialism from Marx and theory. And then basically, socialism isn't homogenous. It's not monolithic. Socialism in Cuba or socialism in Vietnam or China or the Soviet Union or the Nordic countries can be very different, right? And in the United States, spoiler alert, we've had a lot less socialism and it hasn't really taken root in any meaningful way. So especially now to have these alarms and this hysteria is really utterly preposterous, right? So socialism never took root in America. Real communism, really not, right? So what we're really talking about, and this is clearly the case today, is somebody advocating that the state, public institutions, take measures that would actually help people, working people, not just banks and corporations, right? And later on, I'm going to ask Scott to talk a little bit about the way the state subsidizes corporations, because what we're hearing now is everybody wants free stuff when Mamdani is getting attacked for grocery stores and schools and things like that. when in fact the real welfare programs are going to the wealthiest and biggest corporations, right? So just really briefly, really quick, Marx in 30 seconds kind of thing. Anytime you're talking about socialism or communism or any of this, you're going to have to bring in Karl Marx, right? Marx wrote about capitalism, not socialism, right? He was analyzing this fairly recent development of industrialization, industrial capitalism in Europe. And he wrote about it as a mode of analysis. He was examining the material working conditions in England, in Europe, and elsewhere, where you'd seen a shift away from a landed system, a feudal system, where people had massive tracts of land, and then they brought feudal workers and peons in to work that land and gave them a part of it, right? A shift away from that to wage work, where instead of people working for a piece of the land or crops or whatever, they worked a set amount of hours for a wage. Marx talked about the abandonment of the commons. Land used to be held in common. Then all of a sudden, workers would got it. It's a great movie, The Young Marx by Raoul Peck. And at the very beginning, workers are out in the woods collecting wood, just wood that's fallen down in the forest to bring home for firewood. And they're attacked by the private police, the cops, who are hired by these large landowners, right? That's the commons. The commons used to be held in common. You could plant crops. Then all of a sudden you could have sheep, you could whatever. All of a sudden you start to see fencing laws. They put up fences. And then you have the abandonment of the commons, which is really kind of precondition for capitalism. You have a shift away from agriculture to industrialization. I'm not going to go into the theories. There's currently been in the last few years, especially the last 10 or 15 years, actually, a move to put the roots of capitalism within the system of slavery. I don't. I'm more traditional that way. I put it within the context of industrialization, especially in Europe, right? So what you have is a shift away from agriculture to industrialization. And those industrial means of production is the stuff you use to make things with, right? Could be factories, could be looms, it could be iron foundries. The stuff that you use to make stuff with is the means of production. That's held privately. It's held by private individuals, not the state, right? That's what capitalism does, right? And then these workers who are being paid a wage are being, their surplus labor, what Marx calls their surplus labor, is being taken from them. So you give them a wage to work a certain amount of time. They produce a certain amount of goods. Those goods are going to be worth more than their wages. That's their surplus production. And that all will go to the owners of the means of production, the capitalists, right? And that's all controlled economically and politically by this new capitalist class, right? And that's really all I'm going to say about it, right? Now, because that's not the United States. Never has been, certainly not now, right? There's nothing like that, really. And really, what we're talking about there is a classical capitalist system. There hasn't been any challenge to that in the U.S., although we'll talk about people who certainly did question it, right? Socialism would be the result of people rebelling against that new system. This is what Marx wrote about as class struggle. So now with this industrialization, you have this growing industrial class, this ruling class, and then you have a proletarian class, a class of working people. And that struggle, that dialectic would come together based on material conditions. And then you would have the emergence after this class struggle of socialism. And socialism would be a transitory phase between capitalism and what eventually would become real communism. Socialism would be marked, and this is really crucial because we're not seeing this in the U.S. at all. In socialism, workers have the primary role in a socialist economy and in a socialist society. Workers would control the means of production, not private individuals, not Jeff Bezos, not the people who own the oil companies, not the people who own the coal mines, the coal operators, none of them. The workers themselves would own and control the means of production. You would have workers' councils who would run those, create policies, create industrial policy. You would have a public access to the commons. And you would fundamentally have, and this is really crucial, political democracy. Workers themselves and the citizens themselves would be making the rules by which they live their life. It would be what later in the 20th century, people like SDS and Martin Luther King would call participatory democracy, right? That type of socialism was never a real political issue in the U.S., other than in smaller parties and at kind of short pivot points. And we'll talk about a couple of those. It's never been a movement of national meaning. This is where I piss in the punch bowl here, because I know a lot of people on the left have been inspired, as we all have, by some of the great writers like Howard Zinn and others, right? And I think to a large degree, a lot of that stuff has been romanticized. The left history we have in the U.S. isn't really as extended or as successful as we like to believe, right? And I think that's, like I said, Marx, it was a little more than 30 seconds, all right? The other thing that I think is worth noting, because now we see these people comparing VSA to Stalin's gulags or North Korea or whatever. Marx, when he developed this idea of socialism, because it was a transitory phase, he anticipated that it would take root in places that had already experienced capitalist development. And so that level of exploitation of workers, the theft of their surplus production, class struggle would be so pronounced that you would have this struggle to socialism, right? That didn't happen. Russia in 1917 was not an advanced industrial society. China in the 1940s was deeply poor. Cuba and Vietnam were exploited colonial places, right? With, again, mostly agrarian economies. And when not, the means of production were controlled by outside forces, by empire, right? So in America, none of those things really apply, right? So the United States didn't have socialism. Socialism was an anti-capitalist system. You had anti-capitalist groups emerge, to be sure, the Knights of Labor in the 1870s, 1880s, the populists, which we talked about, who wanted national control over things like railroads and banks. The progressive era brought on what were often referred to as gas and water socialists, right?
The Wobblies.
The Wobblies. That's, and for our purpose today, we're going to, that's what socialism is going to mean in the United States. It's not socialism, but we're going to, it's okay if you want to call it that. People call themselves socialists. They advocate that. It's a different system than private ownership of all the means of production. So that's fine, right? We do have public institutions. We have utility companies. We have post office. We have fire department, police forces. They build roads. They build schools. They administer schools. They serve a public function. They are not held privately. That's not socialism in particular, but that's what we're talking about here. If you look at the attacks on Mamdani, that's what you're seeing. So that's the extent of what we see. But the fundamental nature of America's economy, always has been, still is today more than ever, is private ownership of the means of production, private ownership of the banks, private ownership of services, and the primacy of capital over land and property. And that's never been challenged, okay? So, having said all that, let's discuss a little bit just about what socialism has meant. There have been people who did advocate that kind of socialism in the United States, right? And I think the best known would probably be the Socialist Party, right? Which was associated with Gene Debs. And I know you two have been reading some stuff on that, so I'm going to let you talk about what the Socialist Party was, how big it got, how successful it was, what it wanted, tried to do, and so forth.
Sure. Debs ran. I think it is remarkable. I kind of think that the 1920s, and especially the national elections in 1920, were pretty interesting from the perspective that I don't know that Debs necessarily could have won or anything like that. I wouldn't claim anything like that. However, I do think it's interesting that he basically got a million votes from behind a jail cell, from behind jail bars.
And I think that in 1912, he got close to a million too, didn't he? Before 1920. So
I'll say nowhere near as bad in 1912 because we didn't have World War One happening, didn't have any of that other stuff. So I think that 1920 election, that he gets a million votes from behind bars, is pretty important. And you've got guys like Victor Berger who were avowed socialists and literally being kicked out of the House of Representatives. You've got the state of New York being so afraid of socialists that they literally banned the Socialist Party from membership in the state legislature. And you've got however many hundreds of elected officials, from mayors to state representatives to all sorts of positions, who are open and avowed socialists. So there are moments, there are pockets where you can look at it and say it could have been, but it didn't. And I think that I probably subscribe to the ideas that we've talked about, and I know you have talked about on this podcast, that ultimately things like this, like the progressive era and all of that, they ultimately served the interests of capitalism. It was about regulating capitalism so that it would become something that was not, quote unquote, so monstrous in terms of how it's viewed, but it still is ultimately going to support capitalism. So anything that was a reform was only going to go so far. People standing up and going, We're going to, and that part does not ever happen. I don't.
Before we get, in 1912, the Socialist Party had about 110, 115,000 members, which I think is about as big as DSA today. So I just want to say that.
Just to put it out there too, is that DSA are essentially the Social Democrats, a lot of people who.
They call themselves Democratic Socialists.
Yeah. But they're also, they're just a little bit to the left of, they're just, and we're going to talk more about this. They're just a little bit to the left of what the Democratic Party is today. And I feel like there's a little bit of argument going on between the centrists that they actually do more for working people, which they don't, than people on the in this more left space. We had Chomsky on a couple of years ago. I think it was one of the interviews you did with him alone, where he actually talked about Bernie Sanders actually is to the right of the Christian Democrats in Germany, which is the conservative party. So that's an important thing to flag there. And then the other thing that Clayton mentioned, which I think is really relevant today, is that it's in this period of the late teens of the last century, early 20s, as we see the first Red Scare. And so that is very much like what Trump and Rubio and Stephen Miller are trying to replicate now. They've even said that they want this to be worse than, they want to bring back McCarthyism. It reminds me very much of what I've read about the Red Scare from the teens and 20s of the last century. And so I think that's really important, where the government really went after immigrants. They really went after people with socialist ideology. They went after the Wobblies. They went after anarchists. And it's very much, we've done a lot of shows recently about state repression. And to me, it seems very much like that, this period 100 years ago.
Well, yeah. Oh, there's nothing new here. It's an old playbook. Just to give some context, in the early 20th century, which they did. Clayton, also, you mentioned the blowing stuff up. There were actually, like in 1877, you kind of had almost a spontaneous national strike. But in 1894, during the American Railway Union strike against Pullman, Debs, who was the head of the American Railroad Workers Union at the time, and Debs is a real socialist, right? Debs wanted a national strike. And you know who stopped it more than anybody else? It was the American Federation of Labor. So that's another part. So we probably won't go into the
union. They were fake lefties anyway.
So labor has always contained the left as well, the Democrats and labor, right? But in the early 20th century, in Debs' heyday, over 1,000 socialist candidates were elected to office. Two members of Congress, Victor Berger, I forget the other. Wasn't Victor Berger also a mayor in Milwaukee? I don't remember.
I went in for Senate right after the whole debacle.
Dozens of legislators, more than 130 mayors. And this was often referred to, I mentioned before, as gas and water socialism. Because what these folks did, this is the early days when you never really actually had gas and water systems, right? So as they're coming in, they were held publicly. And a lot of cities, like here where I live in Ohio, we still have, the city still has the electric and water systems, right? Not gas, right? And growing up, I think that was common. I'm not so sure it is anymore. I know like in Houston, everything's privately held now, right? Although the city has water. The city does water in Houston.
Yeah, maybe they do. I don't know.
Then you have Reliant or Antext or whatever. Ted Cruz and John Cornyn's pockets, right? So on one hand, you do have a noticeable number of socialists who are running for office and winning. At the same time, the population of the U.S. is probably about 100 million at the time. So we're not talking about like a really broad movement, right? So you have this emerge, and Debs is often associated with Debs. And Debs actually is a traditional socialist, right? He's also, worth noting, a Christian minister, right? So he has, and at the same time, what happens in 1917 is really critical, because the Bolshevik Revolution really becomes a massive hammer that the American ruling class can use against anybody who's suggesting capitalism should be reformed in the least, right?
And even more than that, but it's any critique of, if you want to just call it just broadly, the status quo, they're going to go after it. Because they went after the national PTA because they thought that they were engaging in communist indoctrination, which is patently absurd. But it's anything. You have the rise of the quote race people. So if you're even suggesting that African Americans should have rights, you must be a communist.
Yeah.
So it's way beyond just any sort of real Marxist or socialist critique. It's critique of the status quo, really. That's what they're.
Could Homer Simpson be a communist?
Just a quick reference too, is there's a great book by Robin D.G. Kelly called Hammer and Hoe, which is about the Alabama communists who are fighting for civil rights in the 30s. To put that out there.
I'm glad you brought that up, because just before we came on, I jotted down Scottsboro, right? Because something that's really prevalent right now is you're seeing the Congressional Black Caucus go to Michigan to make these alliances against DSA. And I don't think anybody's been shrieking about DSA as much as James Clyburn, right?
They went to New York with just go against Mamdani too.
And you both brought this up, which is really great and an important point, right? no one defended civil rights in the white community. No one did at all, except for the communists, the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. There is a rich literature on the communists in Harlem, the communists in the Scottsboro Boys. And ironically, a lot of these communists were Jewish as well, right? Yeah.
You mentioned
it's been ignored.
Yes. Yeah. You mentioned Scottsboro, and it just triggered it in me that when I was doing research on Camp Logan, there was after the mutiny, after all of the convictions and all of that, the National Socialist Party or the Socialist Party US, whatever, I think it was Socialist Party US, made a contribution to a defense fund for those who were convicted in the Camp Logan mutiny. Yeah. It also wrote a letter on behalf of those mutineers to the president. And I think it was Coolidge at the time that they wrote the letter to. So, and it was literally one of those
way
moments when I saw it. They were there way more than Sunday school teachers or anything like that.
I think, and this always blows my mind today when I see like Clyburn and Jasmine Crockett and the rest of these people attacking the left. Yeah. These were the only allies in the white community that civil rights leaders had for quite some time, right? And they were active. And this was like, when I was growing up and starting to learn history, this was pretty well accepted, right? It was in Woody Allen movies. Yeah. You'd have characters like crazy Bolshevik Jewish uncles who supported civil rights and stuff like that, right? And so that's been eliminated from it. So there really is. I don't mean to make light of it. And when I say never really took root or didn't do anything, there are people who sincerely did try to create a socialist movement in the U.S. And for lots of reasons, and we'll talk about those obviously as we go along too, it didn't happen now. And you can go back up. I also want to shift now to, because I think the most important pivot point in all this is the Depression and New Deal. Because as you pointed out, there were always, and especially after the Bolshevik Revolution, there were people screaming about communism. Growing up in an Italian-American community, Sacco and Vanzetti, an Italian anarchist, were part of that, right? There's not a bad movie called No Gods, No Masters, which talks about the Italian anarchists in the 20s. Before that, you have the great movie we talked to earlier this year, John Sayles, Made One, right? Awesome. Where Sayles plays a minister in West Virginia who's preaching against the Bolsheviks and communism. So it's already out there. And that's 1921, right? So that's a great scare tactic, which is exactly what we're seeing today. All these memes with sickles and hammers and all this craziness. But I think it really takes root in the 20s. The global depression of the 20s was exactly what the socialists and communists had been predicting. This was the affirmation of Marx's and Lenin's theories of the contradictions of capitalism, right? It had come true. These imperial countries were taking stuff from each other. And the war created such a strain on resources. And then you had this post-war period where nobody was paying off debts. Nobody was paying reparations. Production had come to a standstill. Trade had bottomed out. So basically people said, you know what? Capitalism's new. At the time, capitalism in the U.S. is 60 years old. No, capitalism is basically a post-Civil War development. It's occurring before that. But I also subscribe to that old-fashioned theory that the Civil War actually is a war also for capitalist development, right? It's a way because you can't have a country half agrarian, half feudal, and half capitalist, right?
It launched the arms industry, right?
And railroads and all that. So capitalism is still pretty young when everything crashes in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And at the time, there are two challenges to capitalism, right? One is taking place in Italy and Germany, fascism, corporatism, and the other is Bolshevism, communism, right? Now, as we all know, we don't have to go into it in any detail. Capitalism and fascism have a lot more in common than capitalism and socialism do, right? So Franklin Roosevelt becomes president, and Roosevelt's goal is to preserve capitalism. Roosevelt's a very wealthy guy, right? His goal is to preserve capitalism against these competing ideologies of fascism and communism. He's a Keynesian. And it takes him a while to even come around to that. But the basic idea here is that Roosevelt has to engage in state activity to prevent the economy from getting even worse and ultimately utterly becoming self-destroyed so that either fascism or communism will come into the United States. That's his goal, to prevent fascism or communism from coming into America. And the first New Deal, his first attempts to do that, come via production, come via manufacturing. He wants producers to make less stuff so that their prices will go up and people will pay more money and their profits. So that's not in any way, no socialist in the world would recognize that, right? And it's not until the economy continues to get worse and he's challenged from the left by cultural figures like Woody Guthrie and John Steinbeck or Upton Sinclair, Huey Long politically, right? That's when Roosevelt says, okay, we have to do more. And that's when he starts adapting the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, right? With like the PWP and WPA. And what did those involve? I'll let you guys.
Obviously taking public money and putting it into private hands, no matter even if you just put it into, quote, my hands, what I'm going to ultimately do with it is I'm going to go out and spend it. So it's going to wind up back in, it's going to wind up in private hands. And that's what it's all about. That's what all of this was about. I also wanted to mention, not to get too into the teaching of it, his initial head of the National Industrial Recovery Administration was a general named Hugh Johnson, who was a purchaser on the War Industries Board during World War I. And he had watched the rise of Mussolini and flat out told Roosevelt that the only way out of all of this is for you to adopt a fascist dictatorship here. And I know I'm paraphrasing the letter that he wrote, but the argument from professors always is that Roosevelt rejected that. It's like, but did he? No, he didn't. Always.
No, in 1933, in fact, all over the world, there were articles comparing Roosevelt and Hitler. Sure. They come in roughly at the same time, and they're basically approaching things the same way. So
came out about the same sort of thing, and tons of historians were just aghast that you would even suggest that Roosevelt might have been a fascist.
The idea is that the state and private corporations are going to combine to play in the economy. What did Hitler call, what was the Nazis? National Socialists, right? The idea is you can have this self-contained system where everything you need is within it and you have this planned system, right? They're not socialists, like socialists, they're Nazis, right? But so this is conundrum when he takes over, and his first attempts are really more along the lines of what you're seeing in places like Germany or Italy than anything conjure up.
I just want to throw something else out here too, which is something we've talked about on the show quite a bit, which is around this idea of stability. And we're seeing social, during this period, we're seeing social unrest, we're seeing political unrest, we're seeing strikes, general strikes, farmers pulling guns on bankers when they're going to foreclose on their homes and things like that. And part of this is that Roosevelt is actually trying to stabilize some of this unrest. And it's, you know, that's an important piece of what he's doing. I also want to say that I just saw an article about Alex Carr, who's the head of Palantir, who's basically saying that there's a whole conversation about permanent underclass coming with the new AI economy or whatever. And he, and his response is, we need to figure out how to deal with all the political unrest that's going to come. So it's a little bit also still ties in today.
Now, also worth noting along the theme, in the 1930s, you did have an increase in the socialist and communist parties of the United States. These were the heydays where both claimed nearly a million members, right? And that was based on their critique of capitalism. They looked prophetic or prescient, right? Hey, we told you this was going to happen. But those groups never really took root. And like the communists, the presidential candidate all those years was a guy named William Z. Foster. And the communist slogan was something like, Americanism is 100% Sovietism or something like that, right? Not going to sit well. Now, when Browder took over, and Browder's grandson is now brokering deals, I think, at wheat and stuff like that between Putin and, but anyway, but Browder changed it to communism is 100% Americanism. So this wasn't really rooted in American culture, right? And of course, then you have World War II emerging and you have their alliance with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is neutral. Then it has an agreement with the Nazi Soviet pact and so on. I'm not going to go into any of that, right? But there were, like, again, vibrant political cultures. The political culture of communism is fascinating. Again, there's a big literature on that. Ellen Schrecker, great author we talked to last year. But the communists, not only, so on one hand, they're saying it's toward a Soviet America. That was William Z. Foster. The slogan was toward a Soviet America. Didn't sit well. But at the same time, they had bowling leagues and reading clubs and dances and all kinds, baseball leagues, all that kind of stuff.
This is anecdotal, of course, but one of my grandfathers, but first of all, both of my grandfathers were virulently anti-communist by the time I was growing up. By the time I was around, and both of them said as much. But my grandfather once said that he used to go to Socialist Party meetings in the 1930s because he was a truck driver in the 1930s. And he was talking about how, I went to those because I knew that at a Socialist Party meeting, I was going to get fed. And given how bad things were in the 1930s, you can't reject that. You can't reject getting fed. And it, to me, it's one of those things where it's like, see, it doesn't matter whether you believe or believe or it doesn't matter. It, you're there and you're hearing it. And it's necessarily going to sink into some people. Now, some people may just go, I'm here for the free food and I'm out. But the, there's no denying that, to quote a labor movie, Hoffa, that there's people who are partaking of the benefits, whether they're, you know, walking the picket line or not. So they get it. They're hearing all of this stuff and they know that there's something beneficial and there's something in it for them by going this direction, whether they believe it in their hearts or not. They understand this sort of stuff. And I think it's real. I think that's a thing that's, I don't know, undersold, underutilized, unsung, whatever. I don't know what the right word is, but I think it's important. And and of course it also becomes the ridiculous basis of the McCarthy bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
20 years later, and all these people go to these meetings and it's like, oh, you went to a meeting. You must be a communist.
In the 30s, in those elections, those left parties, like socialists and communists combined, got over 1 million votes.
Yes.
So yeah, there were, again, it's a huge country. So, but there were people, and I don't want to come across as too dismissive of this. There were people who genuinely want to do that. And one thing before Scott, I know you want to say, but when you brought up the farms getting foreclosed and so forth, again, it reminds me of the scene in Grapes of Wrath, Who Do We Shoot? But again, communists would go out to stop the sheriff sales of foreclosed homes, or they would make sure nobody bid. They'd bid a dollar and then turn the deed back to the original owner.
Go ahead.
So communism is a political movement with these parties, but it's also, and this is something you really do, it's mutual aid. That's what Clayton's talking about too, right?
Which that's is what I'm going to say is a lot of that's still going on. That kind of happens all the time. Direct does, action and mutual aid.
The woman who ran in Illinois, Catherine Gonzalez, she ran mutual aid out of her campaign, which, and I think a lot of people are looking at that as a model now. So you have the New Deal is a response to the fear of socialism. Roosevelt is attacked. The old conservatives attack him as a socialist himself. They call him Franklin D. Roosevelt, things like that, right? It's preposterous. In the second New Deal, because of the failure to really address the Depression and this kind of what Charles Beard, great historian, called Thunder on the Left, he does begin these programs, state programs, to subsidize consumption, subsidize employment, PWA, WPA, the Civilian Conservation Corps, et cetera. The idea there is these people aren't working, so they don't have any money. They can't buy anything. Roosevelt's trying to limit production to raise prices. People don't have anything. It's a preposterous idea. Purely capitalist, right? So what Roosevelt does is shift based on these Keynesian ideas and take state money, public money, and create programs for people to go to work. They'll build bridges, they'll build roads, they'll build hospitals, they'll build schools, they'll build health clinics, whatever, public swimming pools, community centers, whatever. Gives them money, and as Clayton pointed out, it then creates this multiplier effect. I get paid, I purchase goods from the local private store, I buy bread, and then they get that money and they buy more bread from their middleman, and then more money goes to the farmer who, for wheat, and it goes on and on. So it's, and at the end, they're paying taxes on it. So whatever the government initially invested, they're going to get taxes back on it anyway, right? So it's state public money. And we're going to get to that because that's what capitalism is. That's what we should be doing today. We shouldn't be shrieking about socialism. We should be talking about capital, which is actually what DSA and Saeed and people, El-Sayed and people like that are doing. But the real subsidies are going to the capitalists. They're building stadiums and polluting the world and things like that, right? So that's what the New Deal did. It took public money. And that angered the capitalist class because, very simply, public money isn't private money. If I'm giving money to some municipality to create a jobs program, Harris County, Texas, Trumbull County, Ohio, whatever, Pittsburgh, you name it, right? Then that's money that's not going to U.S. Steel or to General Motors or to Ford or to IBM or whatever, right? So it's very simple. They don't like public money because it's not going to them. They want the money to go to private, right?
There's also tax increases involved with that, too, which is also what they don't like, right? That's when we create this progressive tax.
Yeah. And this is also World War II is when you have the development of the military industrial complex, which is all publicly subsidized, right? And this is what finally ends the Depression, right? And really creates the template for the economy going forward. Spend as much damn money as you can on the military as an economic program, right?
The other thing I would throw out here too is that part of this is also the de-radicalized labor, right?
Yeah.
Is like we see that we have this radical labor movement where we have in Blair Mountain, we have armed struggle against the coal operators. We have militant strikes. We have citywide strikes. And part of what they do with the New Deal is with the Wagner Act, they bring in labor into the let's call it the capitalist equation. So therefore, it's less of a radical threat and we can deal with it, correct?
Yeah. And part of the deal there was that, especially the CIO, get rid of. That's the thing, too. We see government repression today, right? Far more, actually, I would argue, than we did in the 40s and 50s, because today the state is going in and forcing professors out and so forth. In the 40s and 50s, it was mostly self-directed, right? The unions got rid of the communist organizers, who were actually their best organizers. Universities fired very well-known left professors, right? You didn't need Texas governors and Texas senators to do it. They kind of did it themselves. But yeah, there was this containment of the left, right? A couple of weeks ago, I was on a show with Pascal Robert talking about blacks in the Democratic Party, and he used that phrase quite a bit, the containment of black politics, right? And that's a good way to look at it, I think, right? But those ideas, those Keynesian ideas, and that's what we're talking about today, basically. When we're talking about radical politics, we're essentially talking about some version of what was Keynesian politics using the state, right? But those took root, and they were accepted for really almost a half century, right? Harry Truman and Nixon both talked about a national healthcare system. Labor wanted a bigger piece of the pie. There were laws proposed for jobs programs. There were jobs. I worked in the summer on jobs programs here in Ohio, right? But labor never promoted, never was part of any kind of socialist agenda, didn't seek control in the workplaces. People like the Ruther brothers talked about that, and they were set aside for the AFL for people like initially Gompers and then George Meany and others, right? And they were victimized by McCarthyism. And very importantly, they bought in to military Keynesianism because it worked for them. The working class in the United States in the late 40s and early 50s was experiences as golden age. They made a lot of money all the way really through the 60s, right? They could buy a house, they could send their kid to college, they could take a vacation, maybe even buy a boat or something. They did well. Under this military Keynesian system, we mentioned, I forgot to say this, in the progressive era, there was a very famous pamphlet put out by a sociologist named Werner Selbart, and the title was, Why Is There No Socialism in America? And his answer was basically roast beef. American workers eat roast beef. They're doing too well to organize a socialist movement. I don't agree with that, but you kind of get the point, right? And in the period after World War II, workers are experiencing, white workers, especially industrial workers, are experiencing their golden age. So this is where this idea comes from. What we're seeing today, in many ways, is just recycling that, right?
Yeah.
What's ironic, and you can, if you want to add something, but because I said, take a look at the 1956 Republican platform. I don't know if either of you did you?
Yeah.
The point we were just talking about labor, this is, like word for word, we applaud the effective unhindered collective bargaining, which has brought an early end to the 1956 steel strike. In contrast to the 6 months upheaval, presidential seizure of the steel industry, and ultimate Supreme Court intervention under the last Democrat administration. I mean,
yes.
They're just flat out saying we want that sort of thing. We want unhindered collective bargaining. And it's in contrast, I guess, today nobody would say, you know,
no,
unhindered collective bargaining. These people are pinkos compared to Trump and
the 1956 Republicans.
Or Schumer and Jeffries.
Yeah.
And Schumer and Jeffries. Yeah, exactly.
The Republicans in 1956 had a civil rights planning platform.
Yes.
They talked about federal programs for housing and for education. Education. Education was funded for a long time. The equation was a third. Education got a third of its money locally, like school bonds and stuff, a third from like the state, and a third from the federal government. Federal government money in education now is single digits. So the Republican program in 1956 is not really all that different from what DSA is saying today, right?
There's even a platform on equal rights for women in it.
There's one on refugees, which is that they support providing asylum for thousands of refugees, expellees, and displaced people, and granted a lot of them were from Eastern Europe, but even people fleeing Cuba and Venezuela, which are supposed enemies, like the Trump people deport them all the time.
And you can go all the way up to Reagan and Bush talking about immigrants because it's cheap. To them, it's cheap labor.
Yeah.
That's Trump was able to change the narrative to turn it into this moral issue. They're terrible people and they're committing crimes and they're doing this and that. It's a jobs program for the ruling class. It's a way for the ruling class to basically get really cheap labor, not give them any benefits, not even be held to minimum wage laws or environmental laws, right? One of the reasons you probably have the cyclospora outbreak is because there's no regulations in the fields, right? So in all of these ways, this 1956 Republican program was far more progressive than anything that either party is certainly doing today, right? In the same way, I don't know if I sent it to you. Did I send you that statement from the 1968 Republican platform?
Yep.
I didn't see that.
Yeah. Organized labor has greatly contributed to the economic strength of our country and the well-being of its members. The Republican Party vigorously endorses its key role in our national life. Nixon actually won over some labor leaders when in 72, right?
The Teamsters, the Teamsters endorse him? That's not like,
that's not surprising. I think Al Shanker
sound best surprised by it, but they endorse Nixon.
Al Shanker from the American Federation of Teachers. Nixon that year went on, "We support an equitable minimum wage for American workers. One providing fair wages without unduly increasing unemployment among those on the lowest rung of the economic ladder will improve the Fair Labor Standards Act with its important protection for employees. The 40-hour work week adopted 30 years ago need reexamination to whether or not a shorter work week." The GOP 1968 platform is advocating a shorter work week without loss of wages.
The AI tech barons are proposing that now, too, because
Trump would have Nixon deported.
And this isn't part of the platform, but Nixon engaged in price freezes and something that, you know, until he became America's crazy uncle. Yes. Again, yesterday, Trump never called for that. Nobody would ever call.
I don't know if we've done a show on this or talked about it in a while, but there's definitely something to the idea that Nixon was like the last liberal president that the U.S. has had before we have this sort of neoliberal.
Joan Hoff's a great historian, and years ago, a long time ago now, she wrote a book called Nixon Reconsidered, where she kind of makes that argument. Yeah. So, but obviously the Republicans in 1956 and 1968 weren't socialist. They weren't radical left or anything like that. So the point here is what we're seeing today is possible within the political system. It was actually normal in the political system from 1936 to 1980, right? And you start to see it chiseled away first by Jimmy Carter, and then obviously by Reagan, right? And that also comes after the second phase of this kind of liberal or progressive progress, which was the Great Society, where Lyndon Johnson, taking off on the kinds of things FDR did, and Johnson was a New Dealer, created programs for healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid, significant programs for funding education, jobs programs, and so on. So by the middle 1960s, the United States is running a significant number of programs, publicly financed programs, to help basically working people, right? And this is often referred to as, like today they would call it democratic socialism, social democracy. It's still a private economy. The means of production are still held privately. The banks are owned privately, right? But the state is using some of its funding to give to programs for people, for just regular folks who need medical attention, who need a job, who might need eyeglasses, like Elsie talks about in Michigan, right? And that's what we're talking about here. And this is accepted by both political parties, right? There were a significant number of people in the Republican Party who proudly identified themselves as liberal. And when I don't mean to play into these silly arguments that Republicans today make, but much of the Democratic Party was still segregationist. They were still, until the Civil Voting Rights Act, a lot of these Southern Democrats who are today's Republicans were still behind the times there. So in 1964, liberals, not just Democrats, but liberals dominated the elections that year. People identified proudly as liberals and both parties, right? From 1932, like really until the Carter Reagan years, this is the way America's run. And I wouldn't call it socialist, but it's what they're calling it today, right? And that kind of does bring us up to today. And I think that this all started in earnest in 2016 with Bernie Sanders, right? Like when this current, whatever you want to call it, started.
I mean, they argue a lot that they started with the global finance collapse in 2008, which led to Occupy, led to Sanders.
Yeah, that wasn't identified. I don't think people articulated that as a socialist thing, did they?
There was sort of a reaction to it in the research is when the research.
Well, I think the whole anti-globalization movement from the Battle of Seattle onward has been a critique of capitalism.
Yeah, that's true.
Katrina was a big critique of capitalism and of the failure of the state, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's really the Sanders campaign when you start to actually have these public discussions of socialism.
Yeah, it's definitely when we see the socialism label as a resurgence.
I remember in 2016 that in a class I was teaching that just literally just starting up, because somebody brought up socialism in class and asked, who's the socialist that's running for president in the United States? Tell me who it is. And it was literally the whole class in unison, Bernie Sanders. And it was, okay, tell me what socialist policy. And just literally leading them down a path, obviously. But it was like, tell me which policy he's got that would accomplish anything that's socialism. And it's literally all the stuff that we've been talking about now. And it's like, what? That's America. That's what we do already.
I think we have socialism, which to me would be like workers' control, workers' councils.
Sure.
Like actual participatory democracy, all those kinds of things that would really make it a socialist society. And then you have these public programs, social, democratic, or whatever you call them. And that's, the United States has that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is it socialist? That's why I think the title of this show is really, what is socialism in America? Because in America, it's different than it would be, certainly, you know, we're not going to get into Cuba. But even if these countries, the United States vilifies, they torture states in dungeons, right? Cuba and North Korea actually have kind of exemplary medical systems. Right?
Sure.
China, for what it's worth, did emerge within 30 years. It took 400 million people out of dire poverty, right? Mm. The Soviet Union became an industrial power in 20 years, right? So there is material improvement there.
Yeah. And I was going to say, from a social perspective too, like increases in literacy rates, increases in intellectualism, in all sorts of other things that aren't measured by necessarily economic standards, but these things are happening. Darren, I remember maybe about a decade ago, it was about percentage of the population, like per capita percentages in prisons. And just like literally everybody's like, it's got to be Cuba or it's got to be North Korea. And it was the United States. And it was like, when which country was seeing its, literally quizzing my students about this, but which country is seeing their life expectancy going down? And again, it was Cuba and North Korea and all that. So no, it's the United States. It's like, they're actually doing well in those regards. And the thing that, I don't know, I'll give Nathaniel credit on this one, because he was saying the big problem that he sees and what bothers him most in all of this talking about this stuff is, again, not to say that nobody's talking like this, like you were saying, but not enough for talking about in doing all of this stuff, what are we building? What do we actually build? Because we're talking about doing things that will alleviate student debt, or we'll figure out how to get gas prices down, or we'll call on oil company A, B, C, and D to give back some of their profits. But are we building anything? And we're not. We're just not building things. And you can look at these other places point by point and say, no, they are building something, or they were until something comes in, and it's usually the United States stops it.
Even like one of the arguments you hear today is repression, right? Look at these repressive societies. And in the United States, for the most part, it was actually a relatively free society. It really was for quite some time, right? You could run afoul of the law, absolutely. But for the most part, you didn't have people grabbing you off the streets, right? That kind of thing, right? And then I've been in Cuba, and people in Cuba called it a national security state or security state. And China used to be called a surveillance state. That doesn't even hold anymore, because repression in the U.S. is as bad as it is anywhere, right? Where you do have people who are getting snatched off the streets. Broke my heart this morning, and these Haitian immigrants are being brought in and given ankle monitors, right? Children in
Springfield,
what's that?
Was that in Springfield?
Yeah, in Ohio, yeah. 3, 4, 5-year-old kids are going into immigration courts without a lawyer. These kids are answering judges' questions. They're 5 years old. So the repression thing doesn't fit anymore either, right?
No.
The other part of the argument you often hear is, all those socialists want is free stuff, free, right? Who gets free stuff in America? Who gets free stuff in America?
Okay. The bleeding hearts at the Cato Institute.
The bleeding hearts in Mar-a-Lago.
No, bleeding hearts at Cato Institute. That in the United States, there's $181 billion in corporate subsidies. And that's just in straight up corporate subsidies. That's not including things like when the United States government is taking things like a portfolio approach to buying control in corporations and stuff like that, where it doesn't count stuff like a Walmart or a McDonald's telling their employees that, yes, you're employed by us, but here's how you can also get SNAP benefits, which it's not technically a subsidy, but it's a subsidy because it's subsidizing the pay that these corporations are not willing to engage in with their workers. If you want to just look at it at the $181 billion level, and that's $181 billion annually. And the argument always is that we can't afford this because of this, or it's going to cost too much money, or the cost over a decade would be $2.5 trillion. $181 billion in corporate side. I can't do the math.
Scott was on This Is Revolution a few days ago, and you talked about, particularly with oil companies, right? The ones that Trump says are making too much money, right?
Yeah, just to put a couple of things out there is that according to the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy in 2025, there were 88 companies which paid zero in taxes. There's a bunch of companies. The ones I pulled off of that list of note were Citibank, DT Energy, which is the energy company in Detroit that's been actually in the press a lot in the Michigan race because they're building data centers. Halliburton, I put them on our list because I just like to beat up on them all the time. Palantir, Tesla, right? And also five companies listed by ITEP also include or Alphabet, which is Google, Amazon, Meta, JP Morgan Chase, and NVIDIA, right? Other than Chase, these are all companies that have at some level, like pretty in good with the administration, but this is a long time thing. And then in the energy sector, they're also getting a lot of subsidies as well. What were you going to say? Sorry.
The original idea behind subsidies was development. It starts with Hamilton and Gallatin. They call them bounties. And the point there is you can't have capitalism without immense state intervention. You just can't. There's no such thing as a private economy or a hidden hand, right?
And but there was one class. By the end of the class, I literally said in the class, There is no such thing as real free market capitalism. Yeah. It depends on this sort of stuff. And it might have been after reading an Oxfam report that you assigned or something like that.
We're like Yoda and Luke.
Yeah, it was just startling. It was just absolutely stunning.
My point is, it used to be based on the idea of manufacturing, right? Or subsidizing because people can use these things. They need cars, they need steel, they need railroads, whatever, right? What do they do now? It's AI, it's Google.
And banks,
right? There's not even a pretense of manufacturing or producing something that consumers could use. Yeah. It's just profiteering, right?
Yeah. Explain to me why on that line, Disney got $2.5 billion in subsidies. And it's like Disney turns money.
Mickey Mouse.
I know. I hate Mickey Mouse. I really do. I actually hate ESPN, but
yeah.
But yeah.
Stephen A. Smith is getting subsidized.
Oh my God.
The fossil fuel sector of the $181 billion a year that Cato noted is like about $30 billion of that is subsidies to the fossil fuel sector.
Yeah.
And crazy. And even as our crazy uncle says, Chevron got $12 billion in profits in the last quarter and Exxon got $14 billion in profits in the last quarter. Obviously, this is because of the war in Iran where these...
Which he engineered,
right? But they also, even though they're making these enormous profits, historic profits, they're still getting tax breaks. They get access to public land and public waters for drilling. And then they're also getting price controls. And so it's pretty obscene, honestly, if anything. I was going to say crazy, but we say everything's crazy. It's obscene.
I wonder what that number would be if you included the protection the state provides.
Yeah.
Police exist to protect those people. That's their primary goal. Mm-hmm. ICE is Trump's private militia, right?
Sure.
Sheriffs, troopers. The military goes abroad and that's trillions, right? So that $181 billion is actually more like trillions, right? And then, I don't know, is that just federal $181 billion? Because then you have states, right?
This was federal.
It's from the federal budget.
New York gave the Buffalo Bills, $800 million to build a stadium, right? So it's an immense sum. So what Mamdani's doing, I think we can kind of, this is great. I could talk about this obviously forever, but what Mamdani's doing, and that's, I think, what's kind of brought this most recent spate in. Mamdani won, freaked out Wall Street and the others, right? His basic idea was something that's really pretty consistent with what we've talked about before. One part of it was to have a tax on really rich people. Now, if you look at the maximum tax rates, the marginal tax rates, like in the 50s with Eisenhower, they were 80, 90% for people at the very, very top, but they were basically in the 50, 60% range. Into the 60s, they were still in the 60, 50, 60% range. When Reagan took over, I think they were still at 45%, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's not on every dollar. I think Mamdani's were based on, was it, it was five, half of everything over a billion, right?
Yeah, so it was, like, it's a progressive tax rate.
Yeah, it's a progressive tax, but that first whatever isn't touched.
You touch
it. I think, no, it just depends on what you, I think it was a billion in New York. So that first billion would just be taxed at the regular rate. Anything you make over that would be taxed at 50%, 80% or whatever, right? Once you made a billion, you're good. And then if you made another billion, you would only get 500 million. My God, you'd have to downsize. Oh, you know, I saw the other day, I think it was Tilman Fertitta, UH Regent. He has this private yacht off of Venice. I'm sure they love that.
Yeah.
It takes $1.2 million a day just for fuel for that yacht. $1.2 million a day for fuel, right? But yeah, so the real point here is that the state is using our money every day to subsidize the institutions, which make our lives way worse and way more repressive, right? And what Mamdani wanted to do was tax Wall Street, right? And you notice they, oh, we're going to leave. None of them have left, right? He wants to, they've opened three grocery stores now in New York, which are going to provide groceries at 30% below cost, right? What else? 50, they're building housing units, I think, right?
There's like a rent freeze too, right?
Rent freeze, pre-K for kids, free pre-K or something like that for kids or something like that, right? These programs have existed in the United States in various places and at various times for nearly a century already. The Republican platform of 1956 advocated these programs, right?
Yep.
And funded them way better than anybody is doing today, right? I think we know that this whole communism, socialism thing is a big scare tactic, right? But if you look at what they're really doing, it's, if you want to call it socialism, fine. I think the idea of getting people familiar with socialism is good. I'm all for it. To take the scare tactics out of that word and use it. So if you want to say socialism is the post office, socialism is the fire department, it's not really, but whatever, that's fine. And I've been starting to do that myself. You like the post office? Then you're socialist. That's a very simplistic thing. But I think that's really what we have to do, because obviously Trump is, he's addled. He's as ubats as it gets. But the Democratic Party is piling on, and the Wall Street Journal is piling on. MSNBC is piling on, and everybody except for left media is piling on to this shit, right? And it's also being connected to the war in Israel, right? You're starting to see it. Now, if you oppose the war, if you oppose genocide, you're a radical left communist, right? As well as
anti-Semite.
So this is, I think, what's really crucial here. The real thing we should be doing is obviously critiquing capitalism, which has failed. And for people to say, social, we know socialism fails, capitalism was doing great. No, that's insane. That's the most insane propaganda.
Yeah. And that's literally it. There's no education to any of that sort of stuff. Did socialism, quote, fail? I'd like to see it ever happen without a tax from the outside. If you can show one like that, then sure. But in a lot of ways, and say Cuba's not a failure.
No. When you have an outside force like taking your electricity away from you, it's kind of hard.
It's kind of hard to go.
What happens now, though? Because I think all three of us are really super pleasantly surprised that despite all this, the socialists are doing quite well, right? Yeah. And they're taking on not just Trump and the crazies, but Schumer and his band of crazies, right? And you're seeing, and the Democrats are playing dirty. The thing they did in Michigan where they had a candidate, McMorrow, who was really one of them, and they smeared her as a socialist, right? And essentially in doing so, they're probably making it more likely that Abdul El-Sayed won. But so we have these people in New York who've won. You have, I forget the woman's name, in Colorado who won.
Kira, Milot Kira.
And the Democratic candidate in Wisconsin is going to be from DSA, Francisca Hong. The Senate candidate in Minnesota, she's not necessarily DSA, but she's, I think, being supported by them.
The Senate candidate in Maine is from DSA.
Troy Jackson, DSA. Right. And they're doing well. And if you notice, when the Democrats, the official Democrats, put out their things on, we need money for these Senate races, none of them are included in it. They include Sherrod Brown, Tallarico. Even Tallarico, Tallarico's not a radical. Tallarico is saying things that no one in Texas will say, much to his credit. So
he's definitely got the rhetoric around the billionaires, which is
in affordability and billionaires. Yeah. And yesterday, very clever, because Texas, the land of freedom, has now outlawed Delta 8 and all these other products, which aren't weed. They're not cannabis, right? I used to do Delta 8 there every night to sleep. And immediately, Tallarico put out a really strong statement because personal freedom, that's another thing that's used against socialists. They're going to do the person like, dude, you run the biggest surveillance state in the history of the world and you're attacking the left for personal freedom. I mean, kids got kicked out of school and arrested for saying from the river to the sea and free Palestine. The governor, who is it? The attorney general of Michigan, Dana Nessel. She's afraid to go to the Democrats convention in Michigan because they will boo her and jeer her. And that's anti-Semitic. Like,
that's also Dana Nessel launched an investigation of a bunch of University of Michigan pro-Palestine protesters, which is why she will be booed and jeered and chased down because she's, you know,
but it,
genocide loving.
Socialists believe in free speech. I don't see socialism.
He was the first protesters there. I mean,
this Mondani putting people in jail for their speech.
Oh, no.
He's let these loudmouth freaking Italian macaronis yell and scream. Nothing's happened to them. And that's the thing, like, that liberals don't understand either. In 1924, it was Democratic governors who were attacking these students on campus, violently attacking them with the
2024, not 1924.
What's the difference? Popel did it. Gavin Newsom did it. And notice the media plays into this. The media loves Newsom and they love Shapiro because I'm not being joking here. These guys are to the right of 56 and 68 Republicans.
Gretchen and Whitmer, too. What I want to say is the sort of the digital rhetoric from these centrists is a little bit is fascinating, gross. You look at Neera Tanden spends her day on Twitter attacking leftists. James Carville has actually said that he's going to leave the Democratic Party Hassan Piker becomes more influential.
Great, and nice did promise.
Why is that guy not? He's 81. Why is he not retired yet? Right? Or 85 or something like that. Why is he still around?
I think he's like a lizard, though. He might live to be like 200-300.
Yeah. He's like a tortoise, right?
Yeah. Look at Hassan Piker, who I don't think is a bright guy. Every time he talks, I'm like, I cringe, but young people listen to him. Young people listen to AOC. Mamdani is the most, if you look at a list of the most popular politicians in America, I think 7 of the 10 would be considered left. Right? It's like Bernie Sanders is first, AOC is second, Mamdani is second or third.
Up there,
but, and Biden and Harris are way low and Trump is way low, but the top 10, none of them are like the real crazy right wingers. They're all people who would, and the idea that centrism and moderation and centrism have done nothing but fail. Is Trump a moderate?
No.
I mean, he's a fucking Klansman. And the Democrats are whipping moderate. In the Republican Party, you can, not hyperbolically, you can for real be a violent white supremacist neo-Nazi and you get not just pardoned, but you get a government handout for it.
If we look, this Georgia Senate race is actually playing out to be quite interesting because they keep attacking Ossoff as DSA, which he's not. Yeah. He's a centrist Democrat. Like Zionist centrist Democrat. But then he's being attacked on this by his Senate opponent, who's Mike Collins, who actually has legit connections to neo-Nazis. His son-in-law is a neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
And that actually is not going to get you purged from that party. Definitely not the Republican Party of 1956.
Kristen Gillibrand did a hit job on Al Franken. Gillibrand's son, by the way, just started a like $22 million crypto startup, right?
At 22, out of college.
At 22. And they're the ones who forced McMahon out of the race by spreading rumors that she was DSA. That the funniest part is that your DSA slur, that only works with the Democratic establishment. That's, like I said, the beauty of this is I don't think people care. And if the irony, not the irony, it's predictable actually, is that the Democrats are going to try to sink Abdul El-Sayed. Right?
Of course.
And people for years have been like yelling at me when I said they would rather see the Republicans win than some left. And I know it's true. That wasn't a hyperbolic. That wasn't a joke. They really would. And you're seeing that in Michigan, right?
I think Steve Jeffries said as much the other day. He literally said that our only path to victory, to ultimate victory, is to continue to control the center. And it was like, how's that worked? How's it going?
Who were they to talk about a path to victory? What have they won? I love it when they say they can't win in blue. They can only win in blue districts. How have you ever won? You could barely win, though. You're not winning those. That's the thing. That's when they talk about the other thing, they talk about socialism being anti-democratic. All of these people have won elections. Mamdani won an election. AOC won an election. Bernie Sanders won an election, right? They did. That's the way to do it. They won democratically elect. They were done. Hassan Piker, that's what he talks about, his elections and who they win.
Technically, Plattner won his primary overwhelmingly.
Right? Overwhelmingly, right? And so we're not seeing, like, the unions have sat it out. It's embarrassing. Sean Fain every now and then says something nice. He hasn't done shit. If these were socialists, they'd be having national strikes. It'd be like 1877 or 1894, right? Fain is looking. People from his own union have been taken off the streets and arrested. And labor isn't doing anything. There's never been this real any connection between labor and unions. There's never been a history of political violence in the United States on the left, right? What we're dealing with here is social democracy or Keynesian liberalism or whatever you want to call it. It ain't socialism. But you know what? If you want to call it that, and people like it, then go for it. Because right now, I think people are so fed up that they're like, they see what's the future, right? And they understand capitalism has failed. And this terrifies Schumer and Bessent and all of these people the same, right? Schumer's been very clear. His main purpose is to continue aid to Israel. He said that explicitly, right? The other one is to make sure that capitalism isn't challenged too much. Like Karp said, we need stability. Right?
He's also known as the senator from Citibank.
Oh, he's Chucky Wall Street. I've called him that for years. Yeah. I mean, so is Gillibrand, right? And so was Pelosi. So it
She's
is
the Democrats' crypto point.
So. Yeah. What's ironic, too, is these Democrats going about how radical the Democratic establishment is, a coastal elitist party. Pelosi, Schumer, Jeffries, Gillibrand, and Kamala Harris.
Newsom, yeah.
Newsom. You don't see people from Ohio and Michigan. Tim Ryan from Ohio ran some years ago for speaker against Pelosi, and Pelosi won. And then when Ryan ran for the Senate, Pelosi didn't help him out. This idea, they're a party of coastal elites, rich coastal elites who brag about their $50,000 refrigerators full of Magnum and Dove bars and shit like that. But here we are. But I think it's important. Socialism in the United States means something very different. So if you see a picture of socialism, some propaganda, this is Cuba, so this is North Korea, it's irrelevant. It's absolutely irrelevant, right? We're talking about socialism in America. Socialism in America essentially has existed in the form we're talking about now. The post office, the fire department, public education. There used to be actually federal loans for public education. Now everybody's in debt, right? But pre-K programs, Head Start, which Trump is gutting, right? In America, that's what socialism is, right? When I was a kid, I'm so old, the city used to send a van to all the schools to give us our immunizations every year.
Like everybody of a certain age has a scar right here.
Yes, I do.
I do, because it's not like that. You go in, you stand in line, and they hit that little gun.
That's what DSA is talking about today. That's what they're trying to do today. They're not calling for control of the means of production or to overthrow bourgeois society or anything like that. Some of them are bad at PR. Some of them should not be put in front of a camera. Some of them are idiots. We don't need to be talking about Thanksgiving should be abolished. Which actually, I get what they're saying, but it's not an issue. And the media jumps on that. Thing is, you could say 9 things that are really great, make sense, and you say 1 silly thing, and that's all the media's going to talk about. Every time they interview somebody, the first question is always, does Israel have a right to exist? I'm running for the Senate in Michigan. Who cares? Do the people in Flint have a right to clean water? Do the people in Michigan have a right to not be put into debt because DTE bills?
Yeah.
The people in Texas deserve to have heat in the winter. It's insane. So, and Mamdani's a great politician. And actually, Tallarico is too, even though he's not one of them. They're not apologetic. They're pretty good at that.
Yeah. I think that to bring this a little bit full circle, if anybody is thinking about what, how's it going to build or how, what are we building? I think Scott's on the right idea that it's got to be mutual aid. That's the only way you're going to see it. We've got what we call socialism in America, and what is socialism in America, and what is the mutual aid stuff? If you think about the, like you were talking about with the grocery stores in New York or things like pharmaceuticals, it's not going to happen. Stuff like that is not going to happen through the system. It's going to have to be outside the system and through mutual aid. You want school lunch programs? It's probably going to have to be mutual aid. You want literacy programs? It's going to have to be mutual aid. I know I'd be basically quoting Scott here, but it's organized. That's what you've got to do. If you want to see it, that's what you've got to do.
I stole that from Stokely Carmichael.
If they had,
I'm attributing it to you.
Yeah. If you had, let's say, just like Medicare for all, public health, right? Can you imagine how liberating that would be? People would, they wouldn't have to worry about being sick all the time. They would get treatment, but you wouldn't have to eat shit every day from your boss or whoever. Most people stay in jobs they hate because it might give them health care. Shitty health care that costs a lot, but something, right? Yeah. If you had public health care, that would be liberating. You would have.
I saw somebody the other day saying that if you want to address health care in the United States right now, if you want to do something meaningful to address health care, I think he was saying the NIH maybe needs to gather and distribute. And I don't remember the number, but it was just gather and distribute X number of GLP-1 shots because it'll deal with obesity. It'll eliminate like all of these other secondary problems associated with obesity and all of that. And it'll be a huge boom to the healthcare.
I'm sure the fast food and sugar companies would love that.
And I'm sure that, you know, and I'm sure that the companies that make $1,100 a pop on those shots, they would love that too, right? We're just going to distribute these for free. I mean,
Failure of public health during COVID should tell us all how they feel. They literally, not metaphorically, really don't care if we die. They just don't give a shit if we die. It's like the anti-vaxxing. You don't care should we die.
The other thing on the mutual aid stuff, just real quick, the other thing, I think it actually needs to be two-pronged. I think actually the other thing is one, mutual aid, and the other is this sort of pressure, direct action on companies, bosses, politicians, agencies, what have you. I think on the government side, it's actually very difficult to move things right now because it's run by fanatics. But still, I think that pressure is actually whatever that is, like protest, march, direct action, sabotage, what have you. I think that's still very important.
If I had to pick one thing, if we were only allowed to deal with one issue, to me, it would be Medicare for all, healthcare.
Yep.
Because you're healthier, you're not sick all the time, you're liberated, you don't have that anxiety, that stress. I think that would be the key. And politically, if you were the people responsible for that, you'd win every election for the next 50 years.
What's going to happen with Abdul Said?
And you know which president came closest to doing that? Richard E. Nixon, as Archie Bunker would say. Yeah. Nixon and Teddy Kennedy were in pretty serious negotiations on a national healthcare program until Watergate. Who knows if it would happen, but Nixon was born into the New Deal idea, that whole New Deal era. Everybody just accepted it, right? And that's what these guys are trying to do today. And they were attacked as socialists and communists. But as Ellen Stricker said, it's worse now, the attack. But I think on the bright side, other than the 30% of MAGA left, I think people are seeing through it. And imagine if the Democratic Party actually joined in rather than attack these folks. They attack their own left wing. If you had a living, breathing, with a pulse opposition, and you could actually do something in America right now. But that's not happening. The Democrats should be poised to, and to be sure, to be clear, I hate the fucking Democratic Party. I'd rather see them in control of the House and Senate 10 times out of 10. That's easy, right? And there's a good chance they could win the Senate, but they're going to just sabotage themselves because they don't like the candidates and they're beholden to Israel or whatever. Crypto, data centers. Last thoughts, Clayton?
I think I gave my last thought already because I can't say anything more than what I said about the, you know, organize and then
hate Mickey Mouse and you want everybody to get free GLP.
Mickey Mouse. Yeah, that's right.
GLP shots. Yeah.
God, what?
Brett McAfee and Stephen A. Smith are to blame for everything.
My God.
Yeah. Yes. Misorganized, make trouble and misbehave.
The last thing, there was the Ohio Socialist Party in 1906 had an official song and it was bang. We belong to the Gene Debs gang. Are we socialist? I should smile. We're revolutionists all the while. There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Folks, this is the Green and Red Podcast, and we've been talking about what is socialism in America. Hopefully you found this as illuminating as we have. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to this audio platform, give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Clayton, always a pleasure. Everyone else out there, make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.